another solid week for precious metals investors, with gold and silver stocks blasting higher as sellers scramble to buy back shares. Hello, everybody. Chris Waltzek. It's a pleasure and an honor to be back with you this weekend, with just 1 month or so to go before our big 10-year anniversary. That's right. Each week for 10 consecutive years, an original show has appeared on GoldSeek.com radio, free to the listening audience around the globe. In this week's episode, economist and best-selling author Harry S. Dent Jr. returns with his commentary on the latest FOMC rate decision. The recent equity sell-off could be merely the opening salvo, he thinks, for a new downtrend in the stock market, culminating with multiple price implosions. The downtrend could persist throughout 2016. And the housing echo boom of 2009 to 2015 is losing some momentum as investors and builders brace for higher rates. Bill Murphy from GATA and I discuss this and the precious metals markets. He agrees with friend of the show Jim Rogers that a currency crisis could unfold at any time, sending the metals higher. For instance, the Argentine peso recently blasted higher by 100% relative to gold in 12 months. And we have a new feature on the Alpha Stocks newsletter, daily buy and sell signals on all the major equities markets, built on a surprisingly interesting feature, wavelet analysis. This is cutting edge in academia right now and in hedge funds, with buy stops, sell stops, and recommended trailing stops for multiple equities markets, NASDAQ, S&P 500, the Dow Jones, the DAX, the CAC Coran, the FTSE, the Canadian market, the Australian market, and several others. So if you're already a subscriber, well, you'll have access. And if you'd like to be a new subscriber, we'd like to have you on board. Just send a message to gsr@hughes.net and we'll sign you up. Or you can find the links at the webpage, radio.goldseek.com. And we also have a hotline for listeners' questions and comments. That's 1-206-6665-370. Please jot it down on a Post-it pad or call anytime you like. It's not toll-free, keep in mind, but we'd like to hear your thoughts and comments, and you can leave a first name or remain anonymous if you prefer. 1-206-6665-370. And then Robert Ian wraps up the show with yet another must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the market weather recap. Visibility virtually unlimited over the New York COMEX exchange this week on anticipation of low lending rates for the remainder of this year and well into next year. Investors piled into bullion and shares on news that implied volatilities on the Fed funds futures suggested no rate hike until spring of next year, thanks to an unexpectedly sluggish unemployment number from the Labor Department on Friday. Gold closed near the break-even point at $11.36. Silver added 17 cents, about 1%, finishing around $15.26 an ounce. The XAU Gold and Silver Equities Index finished at 48, and all the sectors look highly solid here. Big signs of accumulation. Also, possible double bottoms showing up. And then there's West Texas Intermediate crude finishing near the break-even point around 45 and a half a barrel, also looking good. Meanwhile, U.S. payrolls on Friday suggested that rates would hold pat at the same level that we've seen over the last decade since about the inception of this show. The last rate hike occurred, well, in 2006. Speculation that Fed policymakers will hold rates steady for longer than anticipated fueled the big rally this week. In particular, news that the much-anticipated U.S. jobs report was more sluggish than anticipated, indicating that global and domestic economic growth might be more tenuous than previously thought. Traders had expected a rate hike in December of this year, but given the weak unemployment number, spring of next year looks more likely. Turning to the mining sector, well, the precious metals equities blasted into the ionosphere this week. Sellers scrambled to buy back shares at increasingly lofty prices. Gold Corp added 5.5%. Agnico Eagle leaped 11%. In fact, all the 21 members of the S&P 500 Gold Index moved higher. Barrick Gold Corp, the world's biggest producer, advanced sharply, gaining about 5%, while Yamana Gold added 6.5%. And the 30-member Philadelphia Stock Exchange advanced 6%. Rand Gold added about 4%. Precious metals, bottom line. Well, signs of accumulation, as I mentioned, showing up across the board. Investors, they like that the rate hike expectations have been lowered sharply here, so sellers will probably continue to buy back shares for the foreseeable future. Moving on to the Wall Street report, partly sunny skies appeared over the equities markets on the New York Stock Exchange this week. Investors sold stocks early on, and that is until Friday, when expectations of a more dovish Fed returned. The Dow Jones Industrials ended at 16,384. The Dow added 157 points, 1%, while the S&P 500 added 20 points, up 1% as well, and the NASDAQ added 21 points, about 0.5%, finishing at 47.07. Meanwhile, equities markets appreciate even a hint of lower rates as it decreases the cost of capital and improves corporate profitability as well as expansion opportunities. Clearly, traders expect the liquidity party to continue well into next year. The Labor Department reported on Friday 142,000 jobs were created in September. That was sharply lower than the 200,000 expected. And the August and July reports were also revised lower. The unemployment rate, however, held unchanged at 5.1%, and the implied volatilities on our 30-day Fed Funds future contract soared with 95% odds of no rate change next month, and then a big increase to around 70% in December. So virtually no chance, at least currently, of a rate hike for the rest of this year. Bottom line, on Wall Street, fear remains elevated in the 7-component sentiment index as well as the VIX index. However, volatility is range-bound with the potential for a big push higher still in the next few weeks. So I think caution is advisable here amid the elevated volatility levels. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Robert Ian, Harry S. Dent Jr., and Bill Murphy from GATA. We'd like for you to stay with us right here. Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Harry S. Dent Jr., editor of the free newsletter Survive and Prosper, H.S. Dent Forecast Newsletter, offers current analysis of economic, financial, and market trends, also author of several bestsellers, so it's a pleasure to have him back here on the show. Welcome back, Harry S. Dent Jr.
Nice to be back, Chris.
Investors weren't terribly pleased with the FOMC's decision to hold rates steady, although most of us had anticipated it. They had been talking about at least a quarter point rate hike at the recent meeting, and now if we look at the implied volatilities in the 30-day Fed funds futures rate, we're not going to have a rate hike at the end of October either. Are they trying to manage, you know, micromanage or macromanage, I guess it is, China, you know, the economic slowdown over there and in Europe? You know, are they concerned that there might be a contagion into the domestic economy?
Yeah, well, you know, Chris, I've been saying the whole year that they would not raise rates this year. They intend to because it'd be the right thing to do. But, you know, we keep seeing weakness around the world. I've been forecasting for years now that commodity prices are collapsing because of the slowing of China. This hits emerging markets, and it's hitting the whole kind of global growth and trade picture, and that's why they didn't move. Now, the Fed keeps saying, oh, we're just looking at the U.S. We don't, you know, manage the world. Oh, no, they balked because of weakness overseas. And again, I don't see a raise in December because I think the stock market's going to be lower in the next couple weeks, and that's going to give them more cause to be cautious.
You know, we've had nothing but a sell-off since the FOMC meeting, downtrend that we've seen following the first hour after the meeting. It's been nothing but down since then. So obviously, it's not what people were expecting. I mean, frankly, the Fed were very confident if the recession was over and our fears, you know, regarding an economic pullback or downturn had passed, that they would certainly pull the trigger on rates because of fears of inflation. And they didn't do that, and they're not going to do it in October, 91% confident of that, even more so than the last meeting. Do you think they really are trapped here? I mean, as many of our guests have said, and they're just not going to be able to pull the trigger on rates at all.
Yeah, I think they are trapped. They're not getting... Another reason they didn't raise rates is that inflation has not come up to their 2% targets. Inflation just keeps not happening because of the broader deflationary trends after the greatest debt bubble in history. And debt bubbles are always followed by deflation. And frankly, that's one of the reasons gold keeps trying to rally, and it should rally here. Gold likes to see inflation. And until we see some inflation, the Fed's not going to raise rates, and you know, we're not going to see this kind of rally in gold and other things that people expect, including me. So it's very unusual here what's happening, but it's because there's a broader deflationary environment. That's why the Fed and the central banks around the world have been printing money nonstop since 2008, because they're fighting deflation with inflation, and they're not succeeding. They can't get, even Japan can't get inflation to come up with three times the stimulus we had. Very unusual. People need to understand that deflation is the trend.
But I think it's important because these themes, these trends are central to, you know, making wise investment choices and positioning one's portfolio, you know, in the best and most profitable direction on a forward basis. And it really caught almost every money manager off guard. You know, they all get on this risk off trade, the long only trade. I mean, even hedge funds, which the prime directive, if you will, was to get rid of risk, to hedge away risk. And they didn't. They said, you know, I'm going to keep up with my colleagues. And so everybody gets heavy on one side of the trade. You're not convinced that trend is going to continue. You think we could see more pain in the equities markets?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Chris, I see this as the first wave down of three major crashes that are going to happen over the next year and a half or so. And I think this wave down is not finished. We're bouncing a little bit off the last little mini crash, but I think we're going to go down into mid-October, somewhere between 14,000 and 15,000 on the Dow, roughly. So another mini crash, and then we'll probably rally into year end. But that'll just be the first wave down, you know, 20% or so in stocks. And then we'll see, I think, the biggest wave down in the first half of 2016. And then a final wave down into late 2016, early 2017. Most crashes happen that way. You know, there's three major waves down and then bounces in between. And the bounces can be strong. So the good news for people that have been caught in this and said, oh, I didn't think the stock market could go this far down, well, wait for the next bounce, maybe into November or December. It could be substantial. And then bounces in the market in stocks is a way to get out, because stocks are going to get hit the hardest here because they are the ultimate risk-on trade that is going to fail after the greatest bubble in history.
I just want to qualify here, bigger believer in reducing exposure, but not completely eliminating any asset class from the portfolio, because in the final analysis, very few people know exactly what's going to happen. And timing the market is not something I want to promote too strongly. But I do want to keep up with an important theme, you know, you've covered in the past, the commodities market. And dollar strength continues for the most part. It's taken a pause here over the last several months. Do you see further pain ahead in commodities? And also, we'd like your views on black gold.
Commodities, by our thing, it's a very clear 30-year cycle. We've been warning for years that commodities were going to peak, and people keep telling me, Harry, you don't know about the growing middle class in the emerging world. And I said, look, I understand that, but the emerging world gets hit harder when we go down, the developed world. And China has been slowing, and they've been the biggest consumer of commodities. So commodities are going down, and we don't see this cycle bottoming until like the early 2020s. That's many years from now, although I think we've seen the worst of it. I mean, iron ore is down over 70%, and coal and oil and all these things. I see oil going to $10 to $20 a barrel before it bottoms. And I think we're going to see $30 to $32 in the months ahead. But ultimately, $10 to $20 a barrel, it's not going to stay there. That's just going to be a bottom. But I see oil in the kind of $20 to $60 range for the next several years. And so that's going to kill all these frackers and the tar sands producers in Canada. And that's exactly what Saudi Arabia wants. They're the low-cost producer at $7 a barrel. We're 55 to 80 here with the frackers. And everybody thought the fracking thing was a revolution, was going to make U.S. independent of oil and all this sort of stuff. It was just a bubble. It only happened because junk bond rates went down to 5 to 6%. Now they're at 8. Next thing you know, they're going to be 10, 15, 20%. And oil prices shot from $32 to $115 just because of global stimulus by central banks.
You know, that's interesting because that would just decimate the upper Midwest.
And Texas, the strongest state in the country. People don't realize that Texas had a recession and a real estate crash in the early to mid-80s because oil dropped, you know, like 70%.
Keep in mind, they also used incredible derivatives in that housing boom there. And I think they learned their lesson. For instance, Houston didn't suffer during the recent housing crash, one of the few major cities to walk away unscathed. But yeah, your point is well made because the fracking business carried the whole middle section of the economy there through the last 6-7 years. Move on to another important part of the financial puzzle, and that's the housing market. The echo boom, quite a remarkable rebound. If we look at it just statistically or on a chart, certainly had a 50% retracement from peak to trough. Nevertheless, we're starting to see some cracks in the foundations. More specifically, seems like almost every important component, anything that could really sustain the market for the long haul, is starting to get a bit thin. For instance, the Fed is obviously going to stop at some point holding rates low. At least that seems to be their mandate. Plus, we're seeing considerably lower disposable income for the median home here. It's about $5,000 or $6,000 less than in 2007, 2008. And there's one other interesting aspect. From a technical perspective, there is a massive diamond in the Philadelphia HGX housing market. This preceded the recent crash in the S&P 500. Give us an idea of what you see in housing.
Yeah, I mean, from my view, housing started a major long-term downturn after the baby boomers were done buying, which is a predictable thing, and the younger generation cannot get loans easily, do not have the same job prospects, and have student loans. So housing started to go down, but the Fed interrupted it with QE 1, 2, 3 plus. So I think housing has bounced back. It's not to new highs in most areas. It's going to go down lower than before in the next several years. So housing, real estate, I think, is going to go back down at least to where the bubble started in January of 2000. And that is 40, 50% lower on average and way lower in some areas like Miami or San Francisco or Manhattan. And everybody thinks you can't lose money buying a $20 million condo.
You've given us a pretty solid overview. I mean, you haven't really been too specific on gold, but obviously you don't see inflation without inflation, expecting deflation still. Interestingly, as we mentioned, Jim Rogers agrees with you. He thinks the dollar will remain strong despite everyone's contention to the opposite. And he thinks that once that peaks out, that's when he's going all in on the precious metals again in the next few years. Any other comments? I mean, for instance, do you think maybe the gold mining sector, the selling there is overdone? It's certainly been a favorite theme recently.
Well, there's no question that gold and gold miners are oversold and they're due for a bounce. But I think the bounce may be more back to 1200 or something on gold. And then it goes down because of the deflation trade. And I agree with Jim Rogers. I'm bullish on the U.S. dollar, but I'm only bullish into around early to mid 2017. I think once the dollar catches up with other currencies, it's been down since 1985, then I would be neutral or slightly bearish on the dollar. So this dollar rally is not going to last forever, but it is going to continue to hit commodities on top of the slowing of China and the emerging world because of commodities collapsing. And China, people say China's growing at 7%. There's no way that they could be growing at 7%. Their statistics are inflated. I think China's growing more at 3.5 to 4%, and they're going to go into the deepest recession we've ever seen in the world. So commodities are going to get hit by China more than anything else. And so you have to wait for the China crash to happen and then reevaluate. And I think when that happens, the dollar will go up as the safe haven in the world. But after that, I'm not bullish long term on the U.S. dollar, because we'll never be what we were in the past decades. But we are the safe haven in this downturn. And I do think the worst of the downturn is going to happen in the next year and a half or two. And so I'll reevaluate gold and the U.S. dollar maybe a year and a half, 2 years from now. But for now, it looks like gold is more down after a rally. It still deserves a rally here. I would use a rally in gold to get out. But when gold does finally go down and find its bottom, in the long term, we're going to have the biggest commodities boom in history for decades to follow, because the emerging world is going to generate all the growth, and they are commodity and gold intensive. Indians and Chinese buy more gold than anybody.
So let's talk about, as we wrap up here, the BRICS nations and the potential energy that you see there. Continued sluggishness in China, which has sort of been poised to surpass the United States as the world's largest economy. I'd like to hear your demographic assessment of China.
Well, China is the only emerging country. It's the largest next to India, which is going to surpass them in population down the road, but the only emerging country that has a declining workforce since 2012, and it's going to decline for decades ahead. So they're growing on urbanization, and the government is force-feeding it at its steroid rates, and that's why they've overexpanded. They just opened the biggest steel plant ever when they're already 40% over capacity in steel. They're building stuff for nobody. Condos, roads, malls, offices, infrastructures, railways. So China's already expanded enough for their growth for the next decade.
China tends to be ahead of the curve. And so why are their policymakers making this mistake from your perspective?
Because they want to grow. They want to grow, and it's all through a top-down system of communist governments who basically guarantee loans for the smaller local governments, and they give all their contracts to their crony partners in business to build stuff for nobody. China is building infinite stuff for nobody. If a business did that, they would be bankrupt by now. And when you overbuild, what do you get? Deflation, because you've got too much capacity, prices fall to clear the capacity. For the next decade, it's the worst place to be, worst place to put your money. India is going to grow because they're the real deal. They are not as urbanized. They have much better demographics for decades ahead. And when China fails, foreign investors are going to say, oh, what's the next big thing? It's India with 1.4 billion people. They're about equal with China today. They're going to be larger in the future. India is the country of the future. And they're going to decline in the future. China's going to actually decline in population.
A similar playbook is Japan, 80s and 90s. That's it. Once again, this growth pattern seems to continue westward. Go west, California to Japan, Japan to China, and now China to India.
Yeah, Southeast Asia and India are the next growth arenas of the world. So when we do have this crash that I'm forecasting, that's going to be very substantial and last for another 2 to 5 years or so, I want to invest in Southeast in South Asia. That's where everything's going. China's already seen most of their boom, and they've overbuilt. They still have urbanization for a couple of decades, but they've already overbuilt for that. They could never build another condo in China and house all the people coming from rural areas for a decade or two. They have 240 million people in cities that are not even registered people in those cities. They're like illegal immigrants in the United States. They don't have access to health care or education or any of the minimal welfare things there. They are trapped. They have no skills. They've just come off the rice paddies, and they can't even move back to the rice paddies because they paved them over with condos that are empty. The huge potential unrest.
A lot to digest, a lot on the plate. Please tell people more about the services you provide, how they can get in touch with you.
Yeah, you know, the best thing, we have a free daily newsletter that keeps people in touch with what we're thinking. It's at harrydent.com. It's that simple. Go to harrydent.com, put in your email, you're on our newsletter, and we'll keep you updated because we think there are major changes coming in the next few years, major threats, and major opportunities.
Thank you. Have a great remainder of the day.
Okay. Thanks, Chris.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of GoldSeek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Bill Murphy is at the helm of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee. Got it with Chris Powell. It's great to have you back.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
You know, interesting story today popped up on the GOTA.org website. One of our favorite guests, Dr. Chris Martinson, has recently endorsed the gold manipulation story. And I can tell you, after many conversations with Dr. Martinson, he wouldn't endorse this story if it didn't have some substance. Can you give us maybe an overview of the gold manipulation story? I mean, I think we all could use one again.
Well, basically, Chris Powell and I, my colleague, thought it was just the bullion banks, you know, the Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, so on, manipulating the gold price after the long-term capital management blew up, because we could see what they were doing in the market and one story after another. It was obvious that they were preventing the price from going up because it would have created some havoc in the banking system, and the Fed got involved and so on. Initially, we thought it was just the bullion banks. Then we realized it was much bigger, that it was the Fed, the Treasury, the Bank of England, the Bank for International Settlements, and it's all-encompassing. And you know, we've been at this since early 1999, exposing this thing, and I think eventually it's going to be the biggest financial scandal in U.S. history when eventually it leads to a blow-up in the gold market, silver market, too. So we're on the case, have been all this time. It's great to have Chris Martinson on board, and the more the merrier that this travesty gets exposed, because it's going to lead to a lot of other dysfunctional things in U.S. financial markets as time goes on. We're starting to see it now, by the way.
I think it's interesting because the crowd just keeps growing. We don't hear of any defectors. I like how Martinson points out eventually the crowd, they ridicule you, fight you, and then they just say you were lucky, and then finally they accept it. The Argentine real has collapsed. Gold has just skyrocketed, just shy of 100% in a year. I mean, that would put gold north of $2,400. And if this sounds like just an anomaly, it also occurred with the ruble about 6 months ago as well. It's like their pillars, the manipulators, the pillars of their support are tumbling. Maybe it's going to take the U.S. dollar to roll over. Jim Rogers had him on recent weeks. He's just waiting for the moment for the U.S. dollar to peak.
Well, it makes sense. You know, the problem is, I guess, that all the currencies stink right now. But the thing with the dollar, which stands out, it's so over-owned by other countries, and that's the difference between a weak currency and the dollar. So when it goes, if people want to get out, there's so many of them all over the world that it would be like a waterfall, and that could create the kind of panic in the gold market in dollar terms as we've seen in other countries, as you brought up.
Okay, well, let's talk a bit about the Federal Reserve. What an interesting story here. You know, I know a lot of people in the gold crowd, they don't want to hear about it. They don't want to talk about the Fed. Well, there's all kinds of agendas there. In the final analysis, whether or not you think they're leading the herd or they're essentially following rates, it looks like there is a lot of lack of unity. Let's call it that, a lack of unity, a lack of coherence at the Fed. As we saw at the latest FOMC meeting, they didn't move rates higher as they'd promised. Wasn't a big surprise. surprise to us because, you know, the Fed funds futures rate said there was a 77% chance they weren't going to raise rates. Now it looks like they won't raise rates in December. So there could be a rate shutout, if you will, for the rest of 2015. What do you think brought about this change of heart at the Fed?
Well, I think the big concern is which is getting a lot of coverage, is the emerging markets, that even the small rate increase could really send them off the edge. So I think, and the Fed mentioned China, of course, and so there's a lot of considerations. But when it comes to the gold price, this whole thing's laughable. If the Fed being at zero for the past 4 years has been nothing but negative for the gold market. So what if it went up 1%, 2%? I know in the 70s, when rates were going up, gold was making its move. It really has nothing to do with it in terms of gold. It has to do with the gold cartel, is that group that I was talking about, and their ability to control the physical markets in gold and silver. And when they start to lose control there, and we think that process is in motion now, albeit slowly, then the gold and silver markets are just going to explode. And it'll probably happen out of nowhere.
We just saw that with the Argentina real. I mean, the currency went vertical. And what I find interesting about it is we here in the United States are in a different situation. We haven't had that hyperinflation for so long, not since you could argue maybe the Civil War. So, we're talking 150 years at least, if not more. So it has left the minds of even our most senior folks here in the United States. We have a heritage of it here in the South, in a region that has grappled with inflation problems and hyperinflation now for decades, if not longer. One would think they would be prepared. But at some point, I guess it could become a problem here as well. All right, let's move on. What do you think could be the tipping point that sends the metals skyward? Have the shorts just run out of ammo? I mean, we're seeing the XAU and the HUI. One wonders how much further they could really fall.
The shares is... Everybody knows who's in them. It's just been beyond terrible. I mean, look at Barrick Gold. We started my website in 98, and God, I mean, Barrick was 17, 18, and the other day it had a 5 handle on it. I mean, that is just beyond comprehension. So everybody's pretty much thrown in the towel in all this, and yet I think when it eventually turns, the moves up will just be spectacular. But many in our camp, including myself, could have said that last year, and look where we are. So I do think it will be some kind of black swan event. Other people think like this for good reason, something we haven't thought of, probably be derivatives related, counterparty risk issues and so on, and then it'll just suddenly feed on itself and it will come upon us very quickly. I think that's what the general population is not prepared for, in terms of the speed that gold and silver are going to move up when they finally take off. Tim, I must say, silver is the worst acting market I've ever seen in 40 years, and it has been for 4.5 years. And every time you think there's a little signs of it changing, it goes right back and acts the way it has been all this time. And many of us are looking for that just to change dramatically, but it just doesn't. You know, what I've been looking at for a while is this open interest in silver, which was about 202,000 and a few months ago, and now it's finally come down to about 156,000. I'm hoping it disappears another 20 or 30, 40,000 contracts. This was at an all-time high a few months ago, and it's just at low prices. It's just ludicrous. I mean, that is just never happens in markets because, there's no reason to hedge when you're way below the cost of production and all that sort of thing. So, I mean, normally open interest would collapse, and it's not been the case, and that's how managed this has been by the paper money crowd, the J.P. Morgans, and so on.
You brought up such an important point, and I think it reminds me of a lot of the reading I've been doing in Nicholas Taleb, Fooled by Randomness, Black Swan, and now Anti-Fragile, where he talks about this interesting concept that markets are incredibly fragile. I mean, more so than like a crystal vase or something. I mean, but unfortunately, we've built up this ideology around the markets. Hedge fund managers and institutions, they're long, primarily long, and even the hedge funds, which are supposed to be about hedging risk, are primarily long-only funds nowadays because it works so well for 6 or 7 years. And then what happens? The market, the equities market, blows up out of the blue. Diamond pattern in the weekly charts, and the S&P collapses. I'm beginning to think, after reading his work and seeing the suddenness and abruptness of moves in these markets, if you don't start accumulating through dollar cost averaging now at these levels, even if they drop another 10 or 20%, you're going to likely miss the move move higher because I don't think they're going to sound the alarm this time. You know, back in 2011, you had an opportunity. I mean, we'd been consolidating in an uptrend for several years at that point. I don't know that it's going to happen like that this time. I think there could be a mad dash back to the precious metals, but what else is on the radar screen today?
I think it's we just pretty much covered in the sense of looking to see if our stock markets all of a sudden just really go into a dive mode. And, you know, in the past, we've had these V-bottoms all the time this past year, and now we are not getting that. In other words, all the dips are bought, but they don't go anywhere. Then they come in and the market's sold again, and it's constantly getting sold. And a real battering of the stock market here could increase the fear trade for gold and for silver, and that also could be a big catalyst, because what's the Fed going to do for an encore? It could be leading to the kind of talk we've had on your radio show today that you brought up.
If they can't risk raising rates a quarter point, given the supposed robust economic numbers that we've seen here for months, what is it that they're seeing that they're not telling the rest of us? And there's been a lot of conjecture that they're nervous about China, which is maybe entering a recession. Europe has been teetering on a recession, you know, due to the peripheral nation issues. They're going to try to take everything down in this deflationary-like mode, which might even hurt commodities a little bit more. And that is when I think the big guys are going to convert their profits into gold, silver, and black gold. I think black gold is going to regain some strength here in the next few months. Bill Murphy from Gata.org and La Metropole Cafe, could you tell folks more and offer any contact information, please?
Sure, Chris. If people want to take out a 2-week free trial to La Metropole Cafe, they can do so and see if it's of value to them, and then a subscription site. And then my colleague Chris Powell puts out great releases that go to www.gata.org and sign up to be on the list. So it's pretty simple.
Well, we appreciate all you do. Thank you, sir.
And thank you, Chris.
Welcome, John Williams.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Just start off here with developments in recent months since we last had you on the broadcast. Hey, we've seen a broad-based rally in the U.S. dollar relative to the euro. How does this factor into your analysis? It certainly would appear, on the one hand, to be at least disinflationary, but my guess is that this is, from your perspective, just an anomaly.
Well, an anomaly would be the way I would view it. Indeed, if the dollar strength continued, it would, I don't know, it would be deflationary, but it certainly would tend to depress inflation rates. The only thing that you have with in the way of deflation, or had in recent years, was back a couple of years as the everything was gyrating following the panic in 2008, and you had oil prices way up and oil prices way down. And if you get a big collapse in oil prices, as we just did, which is also tied to the strength in the dollar, the dollar pretty much drives the oil prices. There's a lot of other factors involving oil prices, but the fact that oil prices right now are low is largely due to the relative strength in the dollar. That brings down gasoline prices. And the gasoline prices are probably as an important factor as you have in the consumer price index, so that in an official reporting, as you had the gasoline prices falling back in, that was 2009, 2010, we had a little bit of official deflation as measured by the consumer price index. However, the consumer price index is some percentage points shy of reality, and I'll contend that if you looked at inflation the way that people used to, that we never really had that shallow deflation. But deflation's not the big issue here, although there are some people that are concerned about a 1930s-style deflation where you had a collapse of the banking system. I think it's going to go the other way, that we're going to have... I'm still looking for a hyperinflation, but coincident with that will be weakness in the dollar, which, again, gets back to your opening question. Let's look at the dollar a minute. The its strength here against the European currencies, the big European currencies, and the yen, is based on several factors that I don't think are going to last and can turn very sharply in terms of market perceptions. Number one is relative economic strength. You look at the rest of the world, it's in recession. You look at our GDP reporting, it looks like we're seeing a booming economy. In fact, the economy that we have seen reported the last two quarters, we're at 4.6% in the third quarter GDP and 4.6 in the second quarter GDP, 3.9% in the third quarter. We haven't seen growth like that since 2003. This is the strongest economy we've seen in a decade, if you can believe the government's numbers. I don't know anyone who's looking at this as the strongest economy in the last a decade in terms of real business activity, but that's how silly the GDP number has gotten. If you look at the GDP or the broad economy as, let's say, measured by the revenues, the sales of the S&P 500 companies, and adjusted for CPI inflation and adjusted for stock buybacks, that you're looking at effectively year-to-year sales, aggregate sales net of inflation, the third quarter contracted, and the economy has been flat for a couple of years. That's per the S&P 500. We haven't seen a booming economy there, and you would rarely see a flat revenues in a major corporate America with the economy supported supposedly booming along at decade-high levels.
New nominal all-time record highs, 117-year high for the Dow Jones Industrials. In its history, never seen anything near 18,000. You're citing buybacks and mergers and things of that nature being a primary component driving demand and absorbing a lot of the supply of shares. That, of course, is helping to catapult equities to new highs, despite the fact that our economic growth is not nearly as robust as our officials would have us believe. Is that a fair assessment?
I mean, the stock prices are at an all-time high. I've got serious problems with where the stock market is, and I don't have a real happy forecast as to where it's going to go. What I'm talking about are the sales of the large companies that compose the stock indices. The S&P 500... you have 500 companies that make up that index. These are large corporations across the board of industries. And what I'm saying is, if you look at their sales, the level of business activity, the level of business activity is not measured by stock prices. It's measured by revenues. The level of what are you actually selling out there? And if you adjust it for inflation, using the government's consumer price index, what you're seeing is that the level of sales of the S&P 500 actually declined in the third quarter. We didn't have an economic surge. We haven't had an economic surge in the sales of the 500 large companies that are in the Standard & Poor's Index. What we've seen is that when you adjust for inflation, their sales level has basically been flat, and it turned down in the third quarter. What I'm saying is that the growth in the economy that's been reported is inconsistent with that. Stock prices are inconsistent with reality as well, and indeed the buybacks do all sorts of things in helping to promote the stock market, as has Fed policy. We can get to the stock market later if you want, but right now what I'm looking at is just a couple of measures of the economy that are suggesting that what we're getting with the GDP is not real. You look at the election, for example. Normally, when pocketbook issues are a big deal, the elections go against the incumbent party in the White House. That's what happened here. If you look at the exit polling as to how people viewed the economy, you had only 26% of the voters indicate that the economy was good or excellent. If you look at that historically, that's consistent with a contracting economy, not a booming economy, an average economy, which would be somewhat shy of 3%. You would have gotten a reading there of about 50%, but down at 26%. And the reality is we're seeing a contracting economy. We're seeing a recession as well as the rest of the world, which is one reason that people begin to recognize that and the numbers turn down in this post-election period. that you're going to see some selling pressure return against the dollar, because relative economic strength is a big factor. And we're in recession. It's demonstrable. People go to my site and look in the upper right-hand corner. There's a copies of the hyperinflation report. The second installment shows you how the economics series, the GDP series, have been played with. They use too low a rate of inflation in reporting the GDP, and that has the effect of spiking the GDP growth. You take out the bad inflation adjustments, and you'll find that what the GDP has shown, instead of collapsing into 2009 and then just rebounding, and right now it's just rebounding and expanding, and again expanding at a pace not seen in 10 years, it collapsed and then basically was stagnant and has been bottom bouncing ever since. That's what you see with the Standard & Poor's. That's what you see with the voting indications. That's what you see with the consumer confidence measures. That's what you see with the housing starts. You take look at factors that have inflation taken out of them. You'll see that the economy has not recovered. Second big point with the dollar is related directly to the economy, because the one of the factors here that triggered the early dollar rally, it was a very deliberate effort here, was the a pullback by the Fed in its quantitative easing. Three, it stopped purchasing net new issuance of treasury bills or notes or bonds. It's keeping its levels constant, but it's not increasing them. Well, what you're seeing in the rest of the world is a lot of noise, and the Japanese have actually done some things, a lot of noise out of Europe that, oh, yes, we're going to debase our currency, too, and where it looks like all of a sudden the Fed is being unusually prudent, and the rest of the world is debasing their currencies all over the place. That's a good reason for moving into the dollar. My contention is that what's happening with the Fed, it was more orchestrated than anything else for it giving us the dollar that we're seeing today. I think part of this is all aimed at putting financial stress on the Russians, a covert economic financial war.
Obviously, crude oil, a huge component of their economic engine, if not the key component. So by having dollar strength, as you alluded to earlier, that, of course, crushes crude oil prices, and we've seen just the biggest decimation since 2008.
As it becomes recognized that our economy is not recovering, not only is not recovering, that it hasn't recovered, or it's heading, that maybe the best we're going to get in the way of the reporting in terms of anything close to accuracy or what people are commonly experiencing will be that the economy is turning down again. Speculation will mount, okay, the Fed's got to come back in and provide liquidity to the system and work to debase the dollar again. That's the big reason that you would see such a shift in the dollar if it looks like the U.S. is in recession again and not booming along. Third area is in the realm of political stability. Big factor if you look at the relative political stability in one country versus another in their currencies. Good measure for that, I found historically, has been the popularity rating of the president, or the positive rating. What we're seeing now is at an all-time low. Normally that would be in an environment where you had a very weak U.S. dollar. You have other factors at play here, too. Our trade deficit is widening again, despite expectations that it would narrow with the lower oil prices. What you have to do from an economic standpoint is look at what's happening with the trade net of inflation. That's how they view the GDP. This will be a negative factor in the fourth quarter GDP because the fourth quarter trade is widening versus the third quarter trade, but it's doing that even before inflation adjustment. Relative trade is a big factor, just basic flow of currencies back and forth with trade. We have a number of factors there that suggest you have a weak dollar ahead. I'm not only looking for a weak dollar, but because the dollar is so far removed from reality at this point that you're going to have a very sharp downside adjustment. There may be currency interventions, all sorts of things that the government will try. what the Fed would need to do if it wanted to fundamentally prop up the dollar would be to raise interest rates. But it's not about to do that because that would kill the stock market and the bond market. So they're back in a conundrum of choices. But bottom line here is that the dollar is going to go lower, and with it, our inflation risks will start to rise rather rapidly. And if you have a panic decline or massive selling of the dollar, as I think will eventually unfold here, you're going to see a very sharp rise in a commodity-based inflation, which will provide a preliminary trigger for the hyperinflation.
Let's talk about interest rates. You alluded to the Fed low intentions of increasing rates because it would eviscerate the housing recovery, that nascent recovery. The Philadelphia Housing Index would likely implode, coinciding with the major equities bull rally. Before we get to stocks and housing, let's talk about the threat of interest rates. Right now, the general consensus, Bloomberg Online and some of the other media outlets, why do you think the FOMC won't raise rates, or if they do, will it just be a token amount?
They're going to be forced into some kind of an easing again to not help the economy, although that's going to be how it's viewed by the public. It might be to help the stock market, but the primary function of the Fed here is to keep the banking system afloat. And if the economy is not recovering, if it's indeed in recession, new recession, deepening recession, however you want to qualify it, that means more financial stress for the banking system. The Fed's got to provide liquidity to the banking system. That's what it did with its quantitative easing. Its quantitative easing did very little to help the domestic economy. The low interest rates helped the banks to make a lot of risk-free income. But the issue here is whether or not they're going to have to keep funding the banks, and the problem, the answer there is going to be yes. And if you look at the federal government, where the cash deficit was order of magnitude $500 billion last year, that's about what the Federal Reserve actually bought in treasuries in the same period. The Fed actually effectively monetized last year's federal budget deficit. That's a very bad sign. That's very inflationary. That's direct monetization of the debt. That's where eventually you go when the government can no longer raise the funds it needs to cover its obligations. You wouldn't think they were there yet, but you could make a pretty good case that the Fed thought they were there yet, given that they were there now, but given the way they've handled this. But the effect there, assuming they start buying treasuries again, will be to support the treasury. It'll be to support the banking system, not the economy. They know there's nothing they can do, really, that'll help the economy. They've said that. They're very open about it. They use guidelines in terms of, maybe we'll look at this or that if the economy does this. But they can't make they cannot take action now that will help the economy. All their bullets have been fired. It's beyond control. So what they'll do, where the economy comes in, is it needing to provide liquidity to the banking system in particular. As the economy weakens, indeed they're going to find ways of putting more liquidity into the system. They're going to blame the economy. The economy is the political cover for them. If they tell the public we're doing this to bail out the banking system, that's not going to be politically popular. But if they say, the economy's weak, we've got to do this again, that's an easy sell. So the right now the Wall Street, the happy story is, the Fed's being virtuous and the economy's so strong they're going to have to raise interest rates next year. The Fed's going to have to raise interest rates next year because they're so virtuous and the economy's strong. That argument's going to disappear pretty quickly. Are interest rates going to go higher? Yes, they have to, eventually. I mean, it's a matter of the Fed can keep buying up the treasuries and keep rates artificially low, but at some point the markets look at this and again they worry about hyperinflation. They say, where's this going? You just don't want to hold the treasuries, and the only people buying the treasuries that sit on the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee. There will be a process there that will move interest rates higher. Normally, long-term interest rates would write about 3% above the inflation rate, order of magnitude. 2%, so long-term interest rate should be up about 5%. Right now, you're still in a situation where you're looking at negative real interest rates at the short end of the curve. It's cheaper for people who make more money, to go out and buy the goods that are going to be inflated and hold them and make money because those goods are going up in value, than to put their money in a treasury bill, which is still viewed as the risk-free investment vehicle.
When one reviews any of the hyperinflationary episodes throughout history, prices increased at a galloping pace. Many merchants became wealthy, just buying, holding on, and then eventually they were ostracized and vilified and accused of stockpiling against the better interest of society. Do you see something like that on the horizon?
Well, if you're going to have a stable circumstance, possibly, but here again, I think eventually you're going to see that the prices are just going to start taking off, and when they do, the people are going to be more concerned about being able to get product and being able to afford it. You're going to have all sorts of problems with this. But just to finish up with the Fed and inflation rates, higher interest rates are actually better for the economy. This low interest rate spiel is basically a banker's game. Low interest rates kill retired people who like to put their savings in something that's safe where they can get a stable return, like maybe get a CD with 4 or 5% interest rate on it, FDIC insured, or treasury bills that'll give you a return that will beat the rate of inflation. When you get retired, you don't want to start putting your money in speculative investments, because that's the only way you can get a return on your money. There's no way you can get a safe return on your money in the United States today because of the Fed's interest rate policies. If interest rates are higher, guess what? Banks then have a little greater a profit margin, and it enables them to make loans with a little higher degree of risk, and they'll lend to people who are a little less creditworthy, with the effect that it stimulates economic activity. What the Fed's doing with its low interest rates helps the banks. It kills retirees, people who are living on savings, and it actually is detrimental to economic activity. But that's not their concern. Their concern is to keep the banking system afloat.
You know, there's a mountain of notional credit derivatives. Huge component of that has interest rate exposure. Some estimates show higher than $1 quadrillion on a worldwide basis. The deflation camp is quite concerned that within the next few years, deleveraging of much of that debt could have a similar impact on the global economy as the 1930s depression.
What happened in the 1930s was you had a collapse in the banking system. People actually lost their the money they had in the banks. And as that happened, you saw the money supply evaporate. Money supply contracted by a third. Inflation, the deflation was actually down by a third. That all required a collapse in the banking system, or back in the collapse in the money supply. If you have highly leveraged derivatives, the notional values, you have, that's an extraordinarily high number, but again, in theory, there's not, the exposure is there. Small percentages of that. The fear here would be that it would collapse the banking system. That's where we were back in 2008. Could the banking system collapse? Yeah, it probably could. And if nothing were done, would it have collapsed in 2008? Yep, probably would have. But what you saw happen then was the Fed did everything it could, along with the Treasury. Irrespective of long-term consequence of the action, they guaranteed all deposits. They created whatever money they had to. They bailed out whatever institutions they had to. As long as they can create the money, they can bail out the institutions. The question is what the currency becomes worth as they do all this. They've gotten through the initial 2008 panic without without a hyperinflation, and again, they did a number of things to keep the banks afloat without pumping up the money supply as it normally would be pumped up. We're coming up to the second stage of the 2008 collapse. Maybe it'll come in the derivatives. I think it could just happen with the weakness in the system as it still exists. Everything that they did in 2008 to salvage the system, to keep it from collapsing, was temporary. Just push things into the future. The banks are still in trouble. The economy is still in trouble. We get to this next crisis, which could be triggered by the dollar or ongoing weakness in the economy, problems in the derivatives. Speculation as to how they address it. But again, I would expect that the powers that be would do whatever that was in their power to prevent the banking system from collapsing.
Do you talk about how the powers that be and our officials, by using this neo-Keynesian model, they are keeping the economy afloat until a later time when normal or more normal economic conditions return to help support and pull us out of the mire? Things aren't the same, that we're not as economically viable as, let's say, the 1970s or even the early 1980s, that our industrial base has been eviscerated and these methods they're using will no longer have the same panacea-like effect on the economy.
I mean, what you say, I think a lot of people are looking at, yeah, we're just in a holding pattern here till things come back. It's going to be decades before this economy comes back. The economy, there's no basis here for the economy to move forward. And the people in Washington know this. It's a circumstance where what they did back in 2008 was not just buying time. It was, we just got to stop the collapse at this point in time, whatever the cost. They didn't do anything fundamentally to improve the system. They just bought time. They didn't know what to do. It's beyond their control. There's nothing much that they can do to stabilize things, to get the economy growing. I mean, if you look at the economy, the issues here are long-term, and certainly not in a circumstance where you have politicians in Washington either in the White House and or in Congress to look at moving things around. Look at the consumer. Median household income. What's a middle household doing in terms of aggregate income? Adjusted for the government's CPI inflation, not my inflation, which is a bigger amount, would show a weaker economy. But just the headline numbers. You're looking at a situation where income today is below where it was in the late 60s, early 1970s. That's for a household. It had picked up in the late 1990s and then started coming down in the 2000s. And when the starting to fall off, as the economy was falling off in 2008, but when the economy rebounded in 2009, it just collapsed. That's something that clearly shows that the economy did not recover. You say, what's happening here? The problem is that incomes are not growing as fast as inflation, even the headline inflation. And the reason for that is that a lot of the higher-paying jobs have been lost to offshore competition. Our trade deficit started to balloon back in the 1970s, and as the higher-paying jobs are lost to and the various trade deals, that brought down the average share of the median household incomes, and the consumer just has never recovered. Now, Greenspan, and he was Fed chairman, he came in 1987 and helped to trigger the stock market crash by raising interest rates in September of that year, and then as the market crashed, his way of saving the stock market was, aside from intervention by the New York Fed buying stocks the second day, was we'll just abandon the dollar here. Don't worry about the dollar. We'll save stocks. And that's been a common approach. Forget the dollar. Forget the budget deficit. you know, those don't have any political import. And you saw a general debasement of the dollar, a general debasement of the U.S. fiscal circumstance. But as it became obvious that the consumer was suffering more and more in terms of his real income, disposable income, Greenspan realized that there's no way to support an ongoing healthy growth in the economy with the consumer and those trade patterns. And what the Fed did at that time was to encourage people to expand debt. If you can't buy it cover your cost of living with your income because your income is dropping relative to your cost of living, you can make up the difference through debt expansion. Usually that the idea is it's temporary, a temporary makeup, but the Fed encouraged debt expansion and debt leverage built upon debt leverage, and that's what gave us the debt bubble coming into 2008. But it also provided most of the growth seen in the economy for the decade before that. As the we hit the 2008 panic, the debt collapse, all of a sudden the consumer still didn't have income growth, now couldn't increase his or her debt meaningfully in order to make up for the income shortfall. And the economy continued to fall off as a result. Consumer funds about 72% of economic activity is measured by the GDP. So the consumer doesn't have the ability to expand consumption. There's no way the economy's going to grow. Not going to happen. So there's no big economic boom in the future here unless we get the trade picture turned around, unless you get people making more basic income. A lot of things have to be done to the economy before that would happen. Not going to happen. So what I see happening here very simply is that you're going to have another 2008-like panic. They're going to do whatever they can, but they're not going to get the support of the world in terms of buying the dollar again as they did back in 2008. The dollar will plummet. As the world runs away from the dollar, so will the Americans. You're going to have a tremendous financial crisis here. You're going to end up with the dollar, as we know it, domestically becoming worthless. Hyperinflation. So for what investors do, if you live in the United States and your world is denominated in U.S. dollars, you do well to cover some of your assets and wealth with physical gold, because the gold will preserve the purchasing power of those assets, get you through the worst of the economic times in a position of having liquidity and having maintained the value of your assets. That's what it's used for here. I mean, the price of gold has been up and down with all sorts of manipulations and with the recent manipulations of the dollar. But I don't care if you get it at $1,000 an ounce, $2,000 an ounce, $5,000 an ounce. When you see the inflation kick in, and the inflation will get worse and worse, you'll see gold at $100,000 an ounce. And there'll be people say, oh, boy, you know, I've made a lot of money here. I'm going to cash out. That's not the purpose of holding the gold. All you've done is you've maintained the purchasing power of the money, the assets that you put into gold. If you liquidate them before the currency system has run its course and the inflation, it'll just become whatever you end up with will become worthless as well if it's dollar denominated from a paper standpoint. It's not a hard asset. So that I look at the precious metals, again, physically holding the precious metals, as the ultimate hedge against the worst of times, against the U.S. dollar, horrible financial circumstances, a way of preserving wealth through difficult times and surviving on the other side of the crisis.
Sure, the listeners would like to hear your thoughts about this equities rally. By some metrics, frothy relative to, let's say, the year 1999, 2000, epic where we saw particularly the NASDAQ blow off top. Now we're seeing many components of the Dow Jones, for instance, and the S&P, as well as the NASDAQ and the Russell, almost parabolic and in some cases straight up on weekly and monthly charts. If history is a guide, we see a tendency for prices to revert to the mean.
There's no way we're seeing anything close to a normal economy, financial system, or stock market. What you're seeing in the stock market's been heavily manipulated, played with. I'd avoid it. It's not. I can tell you, I'm not a stock picker analyst. I'm certainly not into day-to-day timing of things. But what I can give you is a rough thing to look at here. The stock market falls into trouble. And you may, I mean, I wouldn't. I'll just give you a scenario that might happen. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but the ultimate thing here is to look at where it ends up. Let's say I'm right on the dollar, and the economy falters. The Fed begins to ease again, possibly to prop up stocks. And certainly, they've done that before to prop up the stock market. So the economy falters, the stocks start to fall off, the dollar weakens, the Fed comes in and it starts to ease again, intensifying the dollar sell-off, but it rallies the stocks. Stocks go to new highs. I would, under that type of a circumstance, I would urge whoever's looking at it to consider the value of those stocks as priced in terms of gold, in terms of Swiss francs, in times of net of U.S. inflation. And I think what you'll find is that the rallies there haven't been rallies when you look at it in constant dollar terms.
But these themes that we see developing in primary markets have a tendency to gain momentum and persist for years, even decades in some cases.
Well, again, that's all tied to the dollar. That's a transitory.
From your perspective, then, this huge shift that we've seen in the last 3 to 4 years will reverse course abruptly and lead us back into a new bull market?
Well, I wouldn't call it a bull market. Again, I'm looking at end times here in terms of the currency system as we know it. You'll see this happening with anything that right now globally is priced in dollars, such as oil. The dollar sells off sharply. Oil prices in dollar terms is going to rise sharply. That will become very inflationary in the United States. Other dollar-denominated commodities will tend to rise as well. Now, if they're not dollar-denominated, assuming the dollar is selling off here, which I fully expect it will, I mean, that's preconditioned effectively, it'll be even more inflationary in terms of how you see the price, in fact, in the United States. In U.S. dollar terms, prices will be going higher. Now, but that'll be in something that'll be beyond control. I would not, I'd just batten down the hatches, hang on to my gold, and let the system run its course and crash. I mean, it's not a stable circumstance. I wouldn't want to bet on stability of financial markets, even the domestic distribution of goods and services in a hyperinflation. It's going to be very unusual times. You can't call exactly what's going to happen. There are all sorts of things that can happen, but I wouldn't be speculating too much in terms of commodity prices or stock prices outside of the basic holdings of stuff that I needed for myself were in terms of commodities such as gold and silver, physically holding the gold. I mean, if you have the someone's holding a gold certificate for you in Chicago and you need the gold because you're going to use it to do whatever, it'd be a lot easier if you had the physical gold in hand than a piece of paper. You don't know what's going to happen within the system. So you want to just be as conservative and as self-sufficient as possible. In fact, I would look at a circumstance here where it probably makes sense to treat what's going to happen to the dollar as a natural disaster or a man-made disaster. Again, I'm out in California sitting on a major earthquake fault. I'm not here because I want to be here. I mean, I'm with family and I'm going to get out of this general area from the standpoint of what could happen with a natural disaster. But you have to be prepared. You don't know when it's going to hit. And so people out here stock up with food and water to get them through a certain period of time. If you look at a crisis with the dollar, in terms of the purchasing power of the currency, you might well be in a circumstance where maybe the you're going to have some distribution and distribution disruptions where goods don't get to a grocery store. That's a good way for panics to start. But if you have food and water, the basic necessities that you need to get by for a couple of months, A, you survive, and B, you have barterable goods for what probably would be an interim stage of economic or currency activity before a new system, currency system, was set up. The dollar as we know it, I just don't see surviving. I can't tell you how long it will be before. But if you have, if you're holding gold to get you through the system financially, you need a backup of basic goods that will keep you alive and comfortable as well.
I wonder if you might outline what you see as an end game unfolding with the U.S. dollar. You know, keeping with the earthquake metaphor, do you see a revaluation or a sudden Cyprus moment?
I'm happy to address that general area, but the thing is, you don't know how it's going to break. There are any number of ways it can break. What I can tell you that is the virtual certainty here is that the dollar, as we know it, does not survive, that it will become worthless. There'll be currency crisis, there'll be hyperinflation. How it goes from there, how things go politically. I mean, you get your money out of the bank and the money's not worth anything, it doesn't make any difference.
The FOMC, the Federal Reserve, they're an awfully tenacious group. The Fed has managed to live past 100 years of age. If history is a guide, we'll pull out every stop imaginable just to keep the House of Cards from imploding, keep the music going.
I'm sure they will. And in fact, 100 years, you know, that's almost the amount of purchasing power of the dollar that's disappeared, the Fed was created. I think you're down 98%. But of course, that 2% is what we're living with today. If you'd had your money in gold back in 1914, you'd be in a little better shape. The thing is that yes, they're going to do everything that they can, but they're not magicians. There's certain things that you can do with the system, and certain things that you can't. They came up to the limits there. We had, with everything that was done, particularly since 2004, in the terms of the federal government's obligations, all the Fed has done to keep the banking system, financial system afloat with this extraordinary leverage, build upon leverage, and all these derivative instruments, build upon derivative instruments. There's when you come down to the end, there's a day of reckoning. We had that day of reckoning back in 2008. But they said, no, we're not going to accept this. We're going to do everything we can to keep the system from collapsing. And they did. But there was nothing much they could do to resolve the problems. All they could do is paper over some of them and push them into the future. We're at that future now. We're not far from this breaking open again as a continuation of 2008. But they no longer have all the options that they had. I think what's going to be obvious here is that increasingly the rest of the world is not going to be sitting by and saying, okay, United States, we're going to give you another chance here to work this out over the next 5 to 10 years. The rest of the world's going to start saying, okay, U.S., you're on your own. We're dumping the dollar. We're moving ahead without you. The big problem is the United States and the extraordinary excesses that we've put into it, the system in terms of debt and leverage and fiscal improprieties going into the future, where we have right now net present value of what the government needs in hand today to cover its obligations that it's committed to is $100 trillion, 5 times the GDP. There's no way that can be covered. Eventually, and the rest of the world knows it, the U.S. has to either really get its house in fiscal order, which is not politically possible in the current circumstance, or the dollar is going to become worthless. And it's a matter of when people start bailing out of the dollar. You'd have another 2008 crisis.
There are many investors and traders listening to your voice today. Give people an idea of some of the smoke they should be watching for on the horizon. For instance, you would see signs like the U.S. equities market rolling over, as we saw circa 2007. You'd see the U.S. dollar meandering near a bottom, not breaking out to new highs. So certainly the markets are discounting everything that you have outlined here today. We wouldn't be expecting an implosion by, let's say, 2015.
If the markets were anticipating what I'm outlining today, we'd be in a hyperinflation. They're not discounting it. But forget the U.S. equities. That's really more of a derivative market here to the other factors. The key right now is the U.S. dollar and how it's being viewed by the rest of the world, how it's being held by the U.S. the rest of the world. That's the crux of the issue. But I think you're going to see, rather than a smooth transition here to a weaker dollar, it's going to be some kind of a shock to the system that will create a dollar panic, a massive sell-off in the dollar. It's one that the Fed will most likely would respond to try and prop it up, most likely with intervention. I don't think they're going to spike interest rates, which would be a traditional defense against a weak currency, because of the other implications that would have for the domestic financial market. Intervention does not have lasting impact. The thing to look at here, what I'm looking for, sharp turn in the dollar, and one that very rapidly evolves into a massive sell-off. And that starts to happen, everything else that I'm talking about will start to fall into place. Again, if things may be done to rally stocks, but I would look at stocks in terms of the real purchasing power. What is it worth in terms of real money such as gold? Are you better holding the gold than stocks? I have to go back and look at the numbers, but I think you go back to 2000, still did better buying gold than stocks. I'm talking here a long-term perspective, although I'm looking for a very short-term development that puts us in a very awkward situation that gets everything into play.
Oh, no, it's a basic calculation. I mean, gold is 4 to 5 times higher than the year 2000, whereas the Dow is not even 100% higher. Improvement in your assets by just simply holding gold over the past 15 years. So tell folks more about the services that you provide, please, at shadowstats.com.
We have, I put out a newsletter, a weekly commentary. Often there's more than one a week, depending upon economic releases. I assess the numbers as they're released and how they impact the broad picture. We do have also free on the site. That's generally in the upper right-hand column of the homepage. The hyperinflation reports, which detail the basics of what lies ahead, what I'm discussing here. And again, I'm not looking for a near-term happy play in the stock market. I'm looking at survival, and that's what I'm talking about here. This is not a normal, how's the next year going to go? This is when you want to be able to preserve your wealth and assets. That's all discussed here. There's a paper there that explains why the inflation is understated, as the government puts it out. Is it just in normal times? You look at the government's inflation rate and say, oh, that's interesting, inflation's 2%. Most people don't believe that. But if you're, and they're right, if you're looking at an inflation rate that covers the cost of living and maintaining a constant standard of living and reflecting what you're spending out of pocket, that's the way it used to be reported. If you want to have your salary adjusted in a manner that's consistent with maintaining a constant standard of living, if you want to look at an investment return that exceeds inflation on that basis, the problems with the inflation number and where some reality is all discussed there. But again, that's all updated weekly as circumstances change with the newsletter. We're always happy to get new subscribers. It's not very expensive, so if people have a chance to look at it, always welcome to our site. You don't have to put all your assets into gold, but view it as an insurance policy. Same thing with having some goods to I keep you going if the grocery store gets shut down.
No, that's such a good point. You know, just-in-time, remote areas in particular, the just-in-time, you know, method that they use to replenish grocery store shelves is certainly an issue. There is no stockpile in the back. It's not feasible anymore. It's not part of their business model. Most companies would go out of business if they kept large inventories on hand. So I think you make a great point. Plus, add in 50 million food stamp debit cards, and you certainly have the potential for a lot of upset and hungry folks on the horizon. John Williams, we want to thank you for your economic insight, sir.
Well, again, thank you. Thank you for having me on your show.
Hey, Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. The IMF has conveniently given the Fed the perfect cover not to raise interest rates. The fact is, the U.S. cannot withstand an interest rate hike because the majority of its debt is financed on a short-term basis. And despite promises to the contrary of imminent rate hikes at each Fed meeting, we've been getting ready to get ready for that illusory rate hike for nearly a decade in what many like to call a recovering economy. The IMF has reported that higher U.S. interest rates will expose weaknesses in emerging market corporations, which have consumed massive quantities of cheap debt in recent years. The IMF has issued what it calls a double warning over higher U.S. interest rates, which it said could trigger a wave of panic and emerging market corporate defaults in financial markets if liquidity evaporates. In other words, we cannot do anything to jeopardize the punch bowl at the party down the street, or else the unacknowledged punch bowl and party that remains in the U.S. that we are still reliant upon, despite reports to the contrary, will also come to a screeching halt. According to the IMF, corporate debts in emerging markets have increased to $18 trillion, which is up from $4 trillion in 2004, making more companies vulnerable to rising U.S. interest rates. In a pre-released chapter of its latest financial stability report, the IMF warns that as advanced economies normalize monetary policy, emerging markets should prepare for an increase in corporate failures, and that this could spill over to the financial sector and generate a vicious cycle as banks curtail lending. They also indicated the market was prone to what they call sudden evaporation, especially in bond markets, when the Federal Reserve started to raise interest rates. Notice they said when the Fed starts to raise interest rates. I'll say if the Fed starts to raise interest rates, because this report provides another layer of excellent cover and myriad reasons for the Fed not to raise interest rates, because the spillover from other reckless countries could impact the U.S. So we'll just have to bite the bullet and not raise rates, which I believe was never in the cards anyway. The IMF's head of Global Financial Stability Division, Gaston Gallos, said these factors were masking liquidity risks that could trigger violent market swings. He said liquidity is like the oil in an engine. When there's too little of it, the machine starts to stutter. According to a Telegraph article, the IMF said an illusion of abundant liquidity may have encouraged excessive risk-taking by some investors, and that seemingly plentiful market liquidity can suddenly evaporate and lead to systemic financial disruptions. The article posited that banks have scaled back their market-making activities in the wake of the financial crisis, which has reduced their ability to act as a stabilizing force by absorbing excess supply. I remember and actually documented the 2008 crash a bit differently, in that it was the very fact that banks were involved in significant market-making activities that actually helped manifest the crisis in large part. The IMF has now urged European Union policymakers to, quote, reevaluate regulations brought in to restrict transactions on credit default swaps of sovereign debt, which provide insurance against default, but the IMF says has distorted the market. While the IMF said tighter regulation had played a role in tighter liquidity conditions, it said evidence that it would make the next financial crisis worse was still lacking. In other words, the IMF wants to loosen credit standards on a global basis right now. This should be setting off alarm bells with everyone who endured and suffered through 2008. And if you happen to be one of the lucky ones who managed to make it through 2008 without too many scars, there is a possibility you may think I'm putting too much emphasis on these alarm bells. I am not, and time will prove me correct. Chris, I'd like to urge all of our listeners to sign up for my email list at conquerchange.com. Several years ago, I hosted a series of teleseminars on gold and the economy, and will soon begin hosting a series of free Conquer Change webinars. And if any of our listeners are ever involved in bringing in keynote speakers for their companies or professional organizations, please visit my companion website at robertian.com. And until next time, this is Robert Ian, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.